Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Yes, tonight in our Human Condition segment, yet another very significant conversation for our times. Our topic over the last couple of weeks with our resident clinical psychologist, Lynn Worsley, has been about developing ourselves. Now, last week we had a most important and, for me, revealing conversation, I'm sure for lots of people, about a big issue that stems from this self-development. What's behind today's almost epidemic of eating disorders. If you didn't catch it, it is well worth having a listen to the podcast on our Open House Community website. And tonight, the range of treatment options for eating disorders. Lynn, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
It was a great conversation last week. I actually think it's worth touching on a couple of the areas we covered then, because I think we can all learn a great deal about this.
Okay, now over the last 2 weeks, we've looked at the development of self and how that influences the development of disorders such as eating disorders and so on. And we looked at how the mind has an ideal self, which is perfect, and the ought self, which is the person we try to be when we please others, and then the real self or the good enough self.
Yes.
We know that when there's a huge discrepancy between the self we think we should be versus the self we are when we're good enough, then we have a conflict in our brain. And often that conflict comes out in a negative self-talk and a way of thinking that's quite faulty.
Yep.
We then talked last week that in the development of eating disorders, there's often that very big discrepancy in who we ideally would like to be or we think we ought to be and who we actually experience as ourselves. And this might also be complicated by some traumatic experience where there's a loss of control or a sense of helplessness. And the negative self-talk then feeds to finding a sense of control through food and exercise.
Yeah.
But the complication is then that the brain loses nourishment and develops a faulty thinking pattern as a result of malnutrition. And this faulty thinking pattern perpetuates the brain thinking that isn't good enough, resulting in an obsessive pattern of food avoidance or over-exercise or restricting and monitoring our food.
I found that thought of the brain like physically being malnourished very revealing, because that would mean treatment is probably going to be really quite complicated, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. Now, treatment of eating disorders is notoriously hard. The brain, particularly in an adolescent, is not fully developed. And the part of the brain that develops last is the prefrontal cortex. It's that part of the brain where there's a feedback mechanism.
Yes.
This feedback mechanism tells us that our feeling about our feelings and interprets them into information that we can monitor and regulate in our behaviour. And it develops last because it's like the final part of the brain. And the other areas of the brain are foundational to the functioning of the brain, but the prefrontal cortex is a bit like the thermostat of all thermostats.
Okay, yeah.
It processes the intuitive and the feeling parts and works out how to deal with our thoughts and our behaviours.
So hardly surprising that if you don't feed that part of your brain, there'll be a disorder.
Yes.
Is it lifelong or can it develop later?
Well, yes, it can be lifelong. So during adolescence, the brain takes on a few challenges. The important part of the development of the prefrontal cortex is through both taking risks and connecting with people.
Okay.
So when you take risks, the whole body gets into a bit of excitement, a bit like a stress response or adrenaline boost. But when you're connecting with people at the same time, you get a warm and fuzzy response and an emotional boost.
Yep.
So when you put the two together, there's the potential to learn how to manage your risk by talking or taking our emotions into account and to get them in touch with your adrenaline. So it's a great experience for the brain to join the dots. So the adolescent learns consequences and learns to regulate their emotions and their behaviour at
amazing.
The same time.
It's amazing.
It is.
It's just amazing.
But when someone is overly anxious or fearful or has a poor sense of self, that is, they think that they're not good enough, or maybe an overly inflated sense of self.
Yes.
They don't let themselves experience the feedback from others or the emotional response, so they disconnect from people.
Yeah.
And they do this so they can protect themselves from the feelings. And some people use drugs like alcohol and marijuana, and that basically pickles the frontal cortex of the brain.
Yes.
And some people resort to regulating their food, which basically starves the prefrontal cortex of the brain. And then we have a disorder developing. And if that happens during development, it may actually have long-term consequences.
Of lots of things I've heard about eating disorders over the years and covered as a reporter, I don't think I've had such clarity in it over these last couple of weeks. So, for tonight, how do we then go about treating such a complex and costly thing as an eating disorder?
Okay. Firstly, we need to tackle the nourishment of the brain.
Yeah.
This involves getting them early. And studies have shown that those people who've sought help early can reverse the effects of the eating disorder, so there's no long-term effects. Mm. But for those who don't get help or sought to get help early but continue to restrict their food intake and don't build the predictable nourishment that the brain needs, they can end up with a real disconnect in their lives.
Yeah.
And this disconnect can be in a number of forms. So normally the brain can pick up when it's hungry and what food it needs to eat. And when it's full, that is, the brain communicates with the body and tells it what it wants. So like a good example of that is brain functioning well and communicating to the body is when you go to the pantry and you think, and I'm sure you do this all the time, Lee, what am I feeling like? And am I feeling like a biscuit or a dried fruit or a Weet-Bix or a pasta or a cup of tea, or am I just bored and eating for the sake of it?
Or chips.
You've
got to add chips.
Or Coke. No, I'm not going to talk about it. But when there's a disconnect, there is a compulsion to binge.
Okay.
Or restrict, or starve, or overexercise, or gorge, with no communication between the body and the brain. Now, I often talk to clients about how their head is disconnected when they've had anorexia, and the healing process is learning how to connect their head back on again. So to treat the disorder, there's a number of stages we go through to connect the brain to the body again.
So early intervention is critical.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Just when you mentioned exercise, that may seem to some people a strange thing to include in an eating disorder, over-exercise, but that's a very real thing.
That's
I'm
right.
Learning more and more about
that's
that.
That's right, that's yeah. right. And that will also mean that someone becomes obsessed with that and they can lose nourishment to their brain because it's going elsewhere in the body.
Yeah. Okay, so take us through the stages that you go to try and connect the brain to the body, as you said. First stage.
The first stage is getting some help. And I can tell you that the person with the eating disorder will not see that they need help. And they'll do everything possible to stop others from interfering with them. So the eating disorder takes over their whole person and the families and the loved ones. And there are many people will say that there's another person in the house who seems to be controlling everybody.
Everyone. Yeah.
It's like having an extra person.
Yeah.
And to get help then involves the families taking over and getting the person to a clinic or a hospital. And this might involve dragging them to the doctors or the GP and the doctor doing a medical checkup or blood test and weighing and monitoring them. And all of that's very threatening.
And especially when they don't want to do it.
That's right.
Drag, kicking and screaming.
That's right. But the younger the adolescent, the easier to treat, and also the more able the family is to intervene. So the older the adolescent, the harder, of course, to get help.
Yeah.
So my advice is for families who notice that the young person has an eating disorder to get help as soon as possible. Don't wait for them to grow out of it. The first port of call is the GP. The next is either a therapist who works with people with eating disorders or a hospital where they'll be intensely monitored and fed.
Okay. So that's the first stage, getting some help.
Yeah.
Second stage?
The second stage is feeding them. If you go through an outpatient clinic, the purpose of working with them is to feed them and nourish the body. And this may involve some monitoring their food and making sure they eat and don't throw up or stash the food somewhere.
Yeah.
And this might involve getting them to take a chart of their intake each week and gradually trying new foods. My experience with this stage is that it's the hardest. The reason it's so hard is that by feeding them, you actually take control away from them.
Yes.
And the arguments that happen are pretty ugly. And that's why it's helpful to get help. Now, Westmead Children's Hospital in Sydney run an eating disorders clinic, and they've got a number of different treatment modalities. The modality that's the most helpful by far at the moment is the Maudsley model of therapy. And unfortunately, there are a few clinics around in Australia, and the hospitals are overflowing with people seeking this type of treatment.
Yeah, yeah.
At the Resilience Centre where I work, we've recently trained 9 people in the Maudsley model of training. So we're still beginning to, we haven't begun to take clients at this point, but we're starting to get ready for that. But the treatment is absolutely intense. And this involves the whole family attending every weekly session for at least 10 weeks in the first phase and then fortnightly for the next phase. And every member of the family has to attend.
That's a huge commitment for a family.
That's a very big commitment.
You're talking about nearly a year's worth of therapy everyone's got to go to.
That's right.
And families do that.
Yes.
Wow.
And the treatment has had great success.
Okay.
And it's really important to note that this disconnect of the brain has lifelong consequences.
Yes.
So firstly, the person with the eating disorder is actually dying. They're literally starving themselves to death. And with the disconnect of the brain, they really don't know what they're doing. So left to their own devices, they can and they do die.
Yeah.
So secondly, the eating disorder can be a symptom of other things. And without connecting with others in the process of recovery, they can't recover their sense of self, resulting in a lifelong disordered sense of self of who they are.
Yep.
So they might continue to do things to please others or telling themselves that they're just not good enough.
Yeah. So the next stage after that, what happens then?
Well, the next stage involves helping the person and the family to understand the dynamics of their interactions and the effects it has on how they see themselves.
Okay.
It's actually an intense family therapy in the Maudsley model. Usually in the first 10 weeks, it's the feeding process. In the next 20 weeks after that, it is the, you know, really looking at the dynamics. Now, many families find this to be incredibly healing of many aspects of their lives. And I've heard of people actually being thankful for having the time to get closer and to develop their friendships and relationships. But the main aim here is to understand what's happened and the effect of the eating disorder on their thinking.
Yeah.
And interestingly, Lee, many people towards the end of this third stage can't remember what they were like in the first stage, first and second stages. And it's like the brain was so disconnected that there's been a memory switch. And the family, however, can't remember, and therefore it's really important that recovery and healing actually occurs together. I'm sorry, the family can remember.
Yes.
The family are often quite traumatized by what's happened,
yeah.
And they're the ones that need to be healing with the person who's had the eating disorder.
Can I just ask you, you mentioned last week the role of God in this process, and I'd be interested for just a couple of quick reflections on that with this, Lynn.
Look, I stress again that someone with an eating disorder is just not a freak. They're simply someone in trouble, just like you and me. We're all in trouble in some way, and we're all capable of having faulty thinking patterns.
Yes.
Once you're in a path of thinking that it's not good enough, not the ideal, and not doing what you ought to do, you run the risk of thinking towards someone with a disordered sense of self. I loved listening earlier with your interview with Amy Grant. It was wonderful.
She was great, wasn't she? Yeah.
And her song just spoke so much on what this is about. And I'll just quote some of the chorus. The chorus went, "Don't try so hard. God gave you grace so you can't earn it. Don't think you are not worth it, because you are. He gave you his love, and you're lovely with your scars, so don't try so hard." It's a beautiful song.
Yeah.
So that's where I think we need to be concentrating with our eating disorders. We just need to stop trying so hard.
You're a fountain of great wisdom. I think it's been a really helpful conversation, which will continue next week as well. Lynn Worsley, thank you so much for now.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.